We're back here on In Focus News Radio KMAN. I'm Brandon Peoples, Nick McNamara on the other side of the glass, talking today with Dr. Tim Schaefer, assistant professor in the Department of Communication Studies at Kansas State University and the Institute for Civic Discourse as well. We've been talking here a little bit off air about a new collaboration here you're working on with some legislators, in particular Stephen Johnson from Asaria in the 108th District.
Yeah, so some conversations had begun at the beginning of this legislative session, so a number of months ago, but really trying to think about the ways in which our legislators are embodying a lot of the things that we talk about here on the air, of how do people engage in discourse that's productive and not just simply attacking or kind of frankly destructive in some significant ways. And so he had reached out and was really interested in the work that the Institute for Civic Discourse and Democracy does at K-State, and saw an alignment with what he was thinking about. We ended up kind of slow playing it a bit because just the timing of it for the beginning of a semester and all sorts of things, because he really envisions students being involved and coming and being able to have some experience at the Capitol, you know, kind of shadowing legislators and some of the process to see what this idea of political discourse looks like, you know, at both its you know, better forms as well as the not so great kind of moments. But we slowed it down a little bit because we realized we wanted to think through it a little bit more deeply. And so I think we're actually moving pretty closely to a point where we want to put out some more statements and kind of a call for others to join us across the state. So not just looking at it as K-State collaborating with legislators, but also what other similar institutions, you know, maybe the Dole Institute, maybe Docking Institute, both, you know, KU and Fort Hays respectively, and other community organizations who have an interest in this idea of civil discourse, and what are the implications for that in their respective kind of domains. And so one of the projects that I've been a part of and helping shepherd, for example, is through our cooperative extension system, where we've got some folks who work in extension with official appointments and have been developing kind of an analog to the master gardeners model, right? So where people get trained and are capable to do that type of work at that kind of volunteer level, doing something similar with master facilitators. So having people across the state feel comfortable and trained in some of the processes and the things that we typically do, to be able to deal with their own kind of issues in their communities, right? So instead of always having to call the university, for example, and if we're talking about some challenge facing a community in Southwest Kansas, for example, not necessarily needing to try to coordinate some trip from people in Manhattan, that's going to take weeks potentially, right? These types of things. But if there are more localized groups of individuals who are collaborating with the local extension system to be able to think about some of the processes, what are the ways that we might set up a conversation, for example, using a certain approach that's appropriate for what's going on. And so all of those things together, I think, are what Stephen Johnson and I have been kind of thinking about. How do we think about this through a larger kind of ecosystem model? The Kansas Leadership Center, for example, too, down in Wichita, has done a lot of work for a number of years in the area of training people, helping them become truly leaders in their respective domains, their communities, their institutions, their workplaces. So looking at all these different kind of facets of the resources and assets that we have statewide, how do we potentially our Institute for Civic Discourse and Democracy playing a bit of an organizing role for those various entities with some support from the legislature. I don't think that means money. If it does, that's great. But my hunch is that it's going to be much more of a statement, a bipartisan kind of statement that says these are some important things for us to think about politics, both in the formal realms as well as the more informal and localized experiences that most people have, frankly, instead of anything that's going on at the legislature.
Do you think there'll be a lot of buy-in from this?
Well, I don't know. I mean, this is the rub, and this is one of the great challenges for any of this kind of work. NPR, for example, has been having a series called Civility Wars for the last month plus, frankly. And there have been some really important stories that have come out of that that I think highlight the big tensions here. And so one is focused on Charlottesville, for example, right, following after that incident where, you know, a person was killed and we had kind of the expression of that extreme position of what we were talking about a little bit ago of this notion of free speech. Where does that bump up against notions of safety and security concern or the sense of community? For some, civility is a great thing. It affords us the opportunity to engage, to talk. I mean, the same way that we can sit here and talk with one another, we might be disagreeing about something, but if we're going to engage in those ways, that's important. But for lots of others, civility can be this. It can be a tool that diminishes voices, it silences people. It can exclude, and especially when you start thinking about it from marginalized perspectives or communities, civility is used as a weapon, right? I mean, so abide by the rules, play the game. Well, I don't want to. My life's in danger, or these things are going on. So this is where I think some of these challenges are really significant for us to think through. And so back to your question, I think there will be some buy-in, right? And I think there's also a necessity to be really clear about what we mean by something like civility, right? So in the book, the most recent book that I was co-editor of, A Crisis of Civility, we had a chapter by a philosopher, Anthony Layden, who kind of lays out these two different ideas of what civility is or what it can be. One is like civility as politeness, right? Holding your pinky up as you're drinking your tea and following the rules, these types of things. And another is that civility is more about responsiveness, right? How do we choose to engage and interact? And I think for me, that's much more of my interest. It's not so much, and it's not, I should be emphatic here, it's not about silencing people. It's about trying to figure out how do you create space for those kind of different voices, those that you will agree with and those that you don't. I mean, so going back to the implications of media consumption, right? How do you ensure that you have the opportunities for different sources to exist and to have that kind of vibrancy of pluralistic liberal democracy, and at the same time not create conditions where people can then use that as a tool for violence against people, right? And this is the inherent tension, right? How do you create space where people can say just about anything, and then what do you do when people take those things seriously and they go off and do acts of violence towards others? Like this is the real deal. This is the stuff that is most concerning to me as it relates to all of this, because we can say in some theoretical way, yeah, it's great for people to be able to talk or say what they want to say. Okay, but what happens then, right? What are the repercussions? And sometimes, and we've seen this, right? We can, if I don't want to play these rules, I'll just go over here. And there's a community that I could be a part of. There are voices reinforcing what I'm thinking, all that. And if you just only exist in some isolated state of being over there instead of over here with the rest of us, then okay, I guess. But the fact that you're not going to stay in total isolation, and that's going to come back into the mix of things, and that's really where some of the friction comes, right? And of where we see in, you know, kind of the rise of political violence globally. We had a recent incident right in Sri Lanka of extremism that's now been acknowledged as such, based off of religious traditions and things like that. And like, this is where it becomes like the rhetoric, the discourse have implications, right? You can't just talk about some of these things and not think that it's ever going to become real. We've had it happen in the United States, right? We've had many instances, you know, Charlottesville being one example, the shooting in Pittsburgh in the synagogue is another, right? The implications of discourse of both politicians, but also people in media and others who have platforms to kind of share their views, like what they say matters. And for a lot of people, you can just write it off and say, no, that's just whatever saying things, right? They're just trying to get an audience, or they're trying to sell the ads or whatever. But for some, that really all of a sudden taps into a vein, and it's like, yes, that's, I've always been thinking that. Now all of a sudden, you know, you're telling me what to think and what to do. That's huge.
Yeah. Well, that's a good conversation. We got to take a break. Let's continue this conversation when we get back here. Do we have a call? Do we have a call? Okay. Let's go ahead and get this caller on real quick. Then we'll take a break. Good morning. You're on In Focus.
Yeah, I'm just calling this professor you've got on there. You know, Trump got a lot of criticism about the comment he made about Charlottesville on this. He said there was good people on both sides. And I tend to believe that because I was in one of these deals down in St. Augustine, Florida, about 55 years ago. Martin Luther King came down there, and there was friction there with I got in a big fight down there, and I got thrown in jail. There's good people on both sides. I mean, not all of them were skinheads. Not all of them were all Antifa. But the media just keeps pounding away, and these Democrats keep pounding away how he's justifying these people from he's not justifying skinheads and these rest of these clowns, but there's people, legitimate people in there that really didn't want to have those statues removed. So I just wonder what your comment is on this.
Yeah, no, thanks for the call. One quick response here is that it may not be a uniform kind of implication for an audience or for supporters, for example, but the fact that there are segments of that larger audience or group who would then take those statements as being indicative of, explicit support. I mean, so this is where David Duke, for example, the former leader of the KKK, has been very praiseworthy of President Trump. I think because of the implications of some of what's been said. I mean, there's a, if you want to think about it as a spectrum, there are those who are supportive of the president who are very much the same people who are calling for better discourse across the board and aren't necessarily pleased with his language, these types of things. And then on the other end of that spectrum, if we're just operating from those who are to the right politically, you've got these more extreme positions, the ones who are coming into places and, eliciting calls for violence and doing things that are causing damage in lots of ways or even kind of the loss of life. And so I think the concern that I have about kind of the dismissal of the impact or potential of rhetoric is that it does have that ability to tune in to certain people that whether it's through coded language or sometimes it's frankly explicit, right, which is largely where we're existing now, that there's a segment of that population. You know, a colleague of mine who studies the use of memes in the political right, I mean, she makes this point, right? The skinheads that the caller was just referring to, for example, are not the same as the person who has more conservative principles on like tax policy, right? We're not talking about like your views on kind of fiscal policy as it's being talked about at the Fed. We're talking about those who see a kind of ethno-nationalism, like that. Those are radically different things. But the way in which politicians, and it's not only Trump, but he's a classic example of someone who has a masterful command of the way that he uses language, especially through a platform that allows him to communicate directly, right? So back to our first segment when we were talking about Watergate, it's not being filtered through what ABC or NBC, CBS choose to say or report that night at 6 o'clock. It's instantaneous. It's being filtered out through lots of through means. And that's a different kind of scale at which we can think about the implications of what's being said and how it's being filtered or not. And so for some of those individuals who are in that bigger group, they hear what they want and need to hear, and that's kind of a call for action. And so that's, I think, the concern there, just looking particularly at that one, the one case that you were talking about and those who are politically to the right. But I think, you know, we could see some instances on the political left too. We just haven't been seeing those at the same extent or scale. Frankly, some of the protests and things on college campuses We're seeing the more extreme kind of political left, but it's that wave seemingly has passed a few years ago, really the free speech conversations on college campuses. But for example, the instances, the burning of the three churches, the African-American churches, for example, these things, it will be interesting to see what are the influencing factors, what are the elements. Hate crimes have been on the rise in the last few years, unsurprisingly, I think, aligning with the more explicit use of this kind of a more extreme language that is positioning people in some dramatic ways. And so the idea that we're not shaped by a discourse that is more extreme and kind of in your face, I think, is something we need to be thinking about collectively.
All right. Let's take a break. We'll come back more with Dr. Tim Schaefer after this on InFocus.